everybody. Welcome to Stuttering 101. You're here with Eric Jackson, my good buddy Peter Reitzis.
Hey, brother.
Hey, man. And special guest, Dr. Nan Bernstein-Ratner. How are you, Nan?
Fine there.
Excellent. Dr. Bernstein-Ratner is a professor and chairman of the Department of Hearing and Speech Sciences at the University of Maryland at College Park. Nan is known for her work in both stuttering and language and is the editor of numerous chapters and articles addressing language acquisition and fluency in children. Dr. Bernstein-Ratner is a fellow of the American Speech, Language, and Hearing Association, and in 2006 was presented with the Distinguished Researcher Award by the International Fluency Association. Dr. Bernstein-Ratner is also a consultant on program grants for the National Institutes of Health.
All right, so let's get into our main topic. Nan, we want to speak with you today about how language development influences stuttering and therapy. So our first question is, when does stuttering emerge and what language development changes are going on at the time of stuttering onset?
Well, we're starting to get a better handle on when stuttering first emerges because thanks to the internet and the health information that's out there, parents are now bringing kids in for first meetings with professionals a lot earlier than they used to. So it used to be said that stuttering started between the ages of about 2 and 6. But actually, in the recent studies that have gone out there, like the Illinois Longitudinal Project, and said we need these kids within 6 months after they start, and our projects here where we were actually more stringent and wanted them within 3 months after they start, we both reached pretty much a similar estimate, which is that most of the kids start stuttering around a mean age of 2.5 years of age. There are children who start a little younger. We saw kids who were starting before 2 years of age, and there are kids who start older, upwards around near 4. And then there are some kids who start and people who start stuttering at other ages, and we don't know much about them, actually. And they're not, we think they're not the majority, but they're actually somebody, a group we shouldn't forget about. But what's going on at 2.5, when the majority of kids first present with stuttering symptoms, is pretty interesting if you're a person in language development, because that's the period of time when kids are really just starting to put sentences together. And there's basically an explosion of language talent at that point. They're starting to use the grammatical elements of whichever language they're learning. The sentences are getting long and more complicated. And vocabulary is taking off at a tremendous pace. So there are a lot of things happening in a 2-year-old's, in a 2 to 2.5-year-old's life that theoretically could interact with stuttering, and we think it does.
So does a language development then play a role in exacerbating stuttering?
Well, I think that it does. It's sort of a subtle kind of problem, and I think I'll try and answer it in a couple of different ways. One of the things that we know is that stuttering doesn't appear to happen in children from first words. You do get people casually saying that they have had they've had a stuttering problem since they began to talk, but actually we don't have very well documented cases of children who stuttered from the moment they first started saying single words. We just don't have that. And when I said that stuttering starts between 2 and 4, when we see it in the younger kids, the kids who are closer to 2 rather than 2.5, they're kids with rather advanced language development, and they've started to put together sentences earlier than the rest of the crowd. And the children who start to put together sentences later, closer to 4, are the ones that were seen, just a few in our study, but many more in Ehud Yerit's longitudinal study at Illinois, that if you started stuttering late, there was a very good chance that you were a relatively late talker. So there does seem to be some way in which stuttering is exacerbated by the process of language development. And it almost seems as though, and I apologize to whoever great mind, it's probably Oliver Bloodstein, but maybe it's not, who said you have to have enough language to stutter. And that puts the question slightly differently. It actually says that having enough language proficiency is actually a necessary condition for stuttering, that you don't get stuttering when kids are just saying single words. You actually have to have enough language facility, and you have to have enough that you want to say to start stuttering on its way.
You know, Nan, I have a follow-up for that.
Sure, and there are some other ways in which I want to talk about exacerbating stuttering in terms of language, but there are different points at which language exacerbates stuttering. We know clinically when kids are in therapy, for instance, if you have them doing any form of language task that is sort of too hard for them at that point in time, they are going to have stuttering to a high probability, whether or not you're teaching them to manage it using any fluency shaping or stuttering modification skills. That is to say that we know from lots of, these are primarily experimental studies that we've done here and other people have done, but also observational studies, that children who stutter more when they try and say something that's relatively more complicated. And so there is a sense that language requirements exacerbate stuttering once it started.
Well, there's so many questions to ask you here. In therapy with children who stutter, then should parents and clinicians focus on decreasing the language demand to then decrease stuttering?
Well, a fast and wrong answer would be yes. A long and complicated answer would be it's a long and complicated answer. Basically, if you're starting out to teach a child a fluency skill of some sort directly, direct therapy, then you're going to want to make sure that if you're teaching them a skill like fluency shaping skills, prolonging vowels, gentle onsets, whatever, that we're going to want to start that skill training at a tremendously simple level of language formulation. Otherwise, children won't be able to master it. Now, in general, actually, if you look at the kinds of programs that teach children those kinds of skills in particular, they tend to start very basically. That's not really a problem for them. Some programs actually have kids start out by labeling picture cards one word at a time. What tends to be the problem is that the language demand is actually not considered a real programmatic aspect of the training. So the clinician doesn't then try and work up in a really thoughtful way from very simple stuff to harder stuff that looks like the outside world. The opposite problem can happen if you're sort of doing a stuttering modification approach where you're going to sort of catch children as they're having stutter events, as they talk to you casually, and teach them to catch them and modify them. If they're really working in very, very simple speech, they won't have much to stutter on that will prompt the correction. And if they're speaking in very complicated ways, either because it's hard to formulate just linguistically or the thought process is difficult because the question is hard, they're going to have so many stutters, so it's going to be tough to really do anything thoughtful with managing them. So one of the things we emphasize here and in my writing is that most people think of stuttering therapy as stuttering therapy. What I've been trying to get clinicians to think about, particularly with the youngest children who stutter through the age of about age eight from what we can determine, is that when you develop plans for direct treatment of stuttering in children, you have to think long and hard about the linguistic task at hand as well. And so if you do that, then you stand a better chance of achieving your goals than if you sort of don't bother to think about stuttering therapy involving language planning.
I know that Peter works in the schools with a lot of bilingual children. And I was wondering if anything we have been talking about thus far today changes for bilingual children who stutter.
I think the only fair answer to that one is we actually don't know, because not enough bilingual children have been looked at in the fluency literature, and actually in lots of the literature. They're not doing much better in the language disorders literature. We clearly need more work in this area. The available work is kind of all over the place, and I wouldn't say it gives us a very clear picture. There is some sense that there was some old sense that stuttering was more likely in a bilingual child than in a monolingual child, but that turned out to be a very poor rereading and re-quoting of a very old study that when you went back and looked at it was sort of not saying that very well, because it turned out in the sample they looked at that trilingual children actually stuttered less than anybody else. So it clearly wasn't the fact that you had more than one language that was doing anything, and was probably some other issue in the study. We don't think that children who are bilingual need to reduce to one language in order to be fluent. Depending upon how much fluency is affected by other things, like concerns about context of conversation, speaker fears, or anything like that, it may be that therapy doesn't necessarily generalize from one setting to another, but homework assignments by a clinician can do something to help that problem. There is a very recent study, just in the past couple of months, coming out of Great Britain, Peter Howell was one of the authors, that does suggest that bilingual children are more at risk to stutter persistently. Some of us, looking over the article, do have questions about the methodology and definitions used to define children as stuttering and to define children as recovering from stuttering. So I think that pending a more complete analysis of that study, most people are not prepared to commit to that study changing our notions that bilingualism is probably not a risk factor for stuttering. And I think it's been a little bit hard for many of the people in our field to get a hold of that information to look at it, because it was not published in a speech and hearing journal. And so people have only become aware of the work recently.
Let me ask the same question Eric asked in a little bit of a different way. We've had people on Stuttering 101 and on Stutter Talk who have compared stuttering to an allergy or to an asthma of sorts. And so when you're working with a child who might be bilingual or trilingual, and the parents ask, and I've had parents ask me this, should we only speak English for a few months, for a year, until the stuttering goes away? Is there any indication that you see that the language demands are like an allergy or an asthma towards stuttering?
Well, I think language demands are, and we could go back to the earlier set of questions in a minute about that, because I think we didn't fully explore what happens, for instance, with indirect therapies administered by parents. But I think that in terms of the bilingualism itself being a provoking condition, I would disagree that we have evidence for that. It's actually fairly easy for parents to think about this in terms of their own personal problem solving, or even clinicians. And that is, does the stuttering seem really to be more or less frequent in one of the two languages? Most people who are bilingual don't show deficits in using their languages. In other words, it's not like you have one brain and cutting it up into pieces for the languages somehow shortchanges your resources. We don't really think that that's the case to a large extent. So being a bilingual is not bad for your head. And we have seen a couple of cases where children are not balanced bilinguals. A really bad kind of example of this, which I'm sure most of your cases are not, is when, for instance, monolingual parents have a nanny or a caretaker who speaks another language, and the child seems to be having a lot of stress and stuttering in both languages, and they ask if they should reduce down to one language. If I ask them whether the stuttering is worse in the new acquired language, this language that's new, that they're just learning to do, and they say yes, then I might be tempted to sort of put the brakes on adding languages at that point. But most parents don't report that the stuttering is that much different. One of the things we're concerned about in the broad scheme of things is that bilingualism is a good thing for people to have. Bilingualism is a good status. And we don't have a whole lot of Americans who are bilingual. The old joke in my language field is, what do you call a person who speaks one language? An American, not a monolingual. And so we hesitate to recommend that parents somehow take away an asset if we don't see proof, or certainly even suggestion, that the bilingualism is stressful. And parents have a sense of this, and I think that's, they ask us whether or not we have information to guide them, and the answer is we don't, really. And unless they can give us information that would help us figure out whether bilingualism is stressful for their child, we don't have evidence that it's stressful for most children.
I just want to add real quick that the majority of the people I know in Brooklyn speak several languages. So, you know, when I grew up in Delaware, I would agree with you. But where I live now, I feel like the oddball because I only speak English.
Okay. So maybe a bilingual is a person from Brooklyn. I don't know.
I work with children who stutter who are three who get spoken to in three languages.
And we're very interested, by the way. I'll put in a plug because if you've got people calling you and who have children who are bilingual, we're particularly interested in children who stutter, whose languages include English, of course, but also Mandarin and Spanish are the languages that we have the most work on right now. And we're trying to collect cases of these children and really do a structured analysis of how they function in both languages and what their fluency looks like. Because most of the bilingual literature doesn't even ask the question whether a child stutters more or differently if they have more than one language. They're basically demographic studies. They grab up bunches of people who are bilingual and bunches of people who are not and ask whether stuttering is more or less frequent in that population. And that's a terribly risky method for doing that kind of work.
Why?
Because you miss other variables there. It is really, really tough to understand. The numbers tend not to be very, very helpful. The population, both populations stutter, and when you're busy trying to look at variations in a relatively infrequent disorder anyhow, it is very hard to balance the data out on other variables there. So we're trying to get at it at a different way, but not too many sites have done this, which is to take the people who are speaking more than one language and asking whether or not there is something going on in their speech in the two languages that would help us understand whether language formulation as a bilingual is doing something there.
Nan, for children who appear to have both language delays and some stuttering going on, how does the clinician determine how much time to spend addressing these language delays and how much time to spend addressing stuttering?
Well, there are a couple of answers to that one, too. So the first one that we normally request people to think about when they say they have a kid who's language delayed and stutters is to make sure they actually stutter. Some of the work we've done recently and Nancy Hall has done suggests that some of those kids aren't really stuttering. They're very, very disfluent, but their events, their moments of stuttering don't look like classic stutters, and they don't have a self-concept as a child who stutters. So, but if we do, in fact, diagnose real stuttering in a child who's also in therapy or under treatment for language, what we find is that, practically speaking, a lot of therapists out there would just prefer to work on the language because it's more important and because they're more comfortable doing language therapy. Mm-hmm. And that's probably not a good strategy because we know that children with language problems basically are going to require help forever in some respects. Language is an infinite system, and people like Leslie Rescorla, who have followed late talkers all through their lives, know that they never fully catch up. They always need some sort of help that changes over time. So if you wait for a kid to be perfectly wonderful on every language test, you'll never stop treating the language problem and you'll never get to the stutter, and that would not be right. So we do ask people to kind of weave in both therapies when kids have both needs. But we do ask clinicians to be especially concerned about making sure that any language tasks that are done during fluency therapy, for fluency therapy purposes, are really simple language tasks. Because otherwise, these kids who already have language formulation demands are going to have significant problems being fluent. And the other thing that we suggest, depending upon how they were trained and how vociferously they hold to certain philosophies of remediation, treatment for stuttering, is that if they are avid fluency shapers with young kids, that they consider, in a child who has both language problems and stuttering, that child be taught some stuttering modification strategies. because our philosophy is that these children are going to find it very difficult to be perfectly fluent. They have language formulation problems, and language formulation problems cause fluency breakdown. And if you don't teach kids what to do when that happens, you're essentially depriving them of a strategy that they're going to need, we think. Because we don't believe that simply teaching them fluency shaping strategies will guarantee that they never have a stutter again.
What age group are you talking about when you...
This would be the age group between, say, 3 and 10.
Yeah, see, I like that a lot. I actually have done quite a bit of stuttering modification with 4-year-olds and 3-year-olds, and you know, I obviously use language that's age-appropriate, but I've had a lot of speech pathologists suggest to me that that's blasphemy, that you never teach a child how to move through a stutter, and I just don't understand. Like, I mean, I'll give you one quick example. I worked with a child who was 3 who used to bring his Dora doll to speech therapy, and he would tell me that his Dora doll had trouble talking. So we would teach the Dora doll how to stutter soft, how to stutter hard, how to move through the stutters. And it amazes me that some people in our field find that to be harmful or wrong.
Well, I think it's a misinterpretation over time of an early enthusiasm that accompanied fluency shaping when it first came around. Stuttering modification therapy was much older. It had been around. And fluency shaping therapy came about, seemed more of a scientific speech motor kind of approach to stuttering. And there were people who, I think, went a bit too far in their enthusiasm, suggesting that this new way of approaching stuttering was better and had the potential to eradicate stuttering. And that if you believe that, then therapy time that was spent teaching you to catch and manage your stutters was sort of defeatist. I don't think that that's true at all at any age, even if you don't have an accompanying language problem. But I do think that there are cases where it's absolutely inexcusable, and one of them would be the case of a child who has multiple problems like that, because our feeling is that that's a child who's not going to be able to apply those strategies in a fail-proof manner. The system has too much formulation pressure on it. And I think it's equivalent to sending people out, you know, to fight for us in the Army with a gun with only half loaded with bullets. I mean, that's not quite right.
Yeah.
You know, so that's probably too much of a fierce analogy here. We should find something more peaceful. But I think it's really not giving people the equipment that they need.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. What do you think of the classic advice to have the parents slow down or the clinicians slow down in the hope that the child will then slow down?
Yeah, there's a lot of advice that started within RIPER and perhaps even earlier, saying that if parents would slow down and speak more simply and reduce those kinds of demands on children, that their speech would be more fluent. It's kind of astounding and disappointing that comments like that were made for at least 50 years before anybody decided to do any research on the topic. The minute people started doing small amounts of research on the topic, and we don't have quite enough at this point at all, immediately it got more complicated than it looked. So it is true in a few studies that if you slow parent speech rate down, children do seem to become slightly more fluent, in some cases really 50% more fluent in one of the cases I reported, but it's not because the child slows down, so that's immediately very mystifying.
Right, right.
And it seems to be that what happens when parents slow down is the pace of conversation slows down, and so people don't start talking after other people stop talking quite as fast. We think what might be going on there is a little bit of the grandmotherly advice that people should think before they talk if they want to speak more fluently. So we think that we do still advise that parents slow down and see what happens. And very many times parents come back and say that it's good. It's not only helping their child to become a little bit more fluent, it does not cure stuttering, let me put that right out there, but that their child is somewhat more fluent and life is actually somewhat more relaxing. But the other thing that's often said at the same time and is very commonly seen in advisements on websites and other public service announcements is that the parent should also speak more simply to their child. And that gets back to the questions you were asking earlier about does language exacerbate stuttering? And so the original comment that Van Riper said is if you want to have a fluent child, model easy less complicated language, and they will be able to approach that task more easily. What we know, there's only been one study really that looked at this, and I did that a while back. What we know is that it doesn't seem to help. If parents shorten and simplify their utterances to kids, the kids don't get more fluent. In this case, we used a larger sample of children who had normal developmental disfluency, not stuttering, but absolutely nothing happened. And the children don't seem to model that behavior either. So if parents talk in short, simple utterances, kids just they don't seem to be paying attention to what their parents are saying. They just rattle on anyhow.
Okay.
And there's a potential, as I said, with the bilingualism issue, sometimes we can overreact and we can take something away that might be beneficial. So we know that when parents speak to their kids using fairly sophisticated language, we're not talking about having your child spoken to as though, you know, the Treasury Secretary or something, but the issue is that when parents use good long sentences to their kids, use a variety of words, children do well in language development. It's one of the few good correlations we have out there. And so if we counsel parents to do something to strip down their language to kids who stutter, we may actually be hurting them in the long run.
Yeah.
It may actually wind up being something that shows up on the SAT, you know, that they're somewhere less on the verbal scale because their parents didn't talk to them as much. But I worry that until we have more data that suggests that if parents use shorter, simpler utterances, their kids do well, I wouldn't do that. And we actually tell our parents to ignore that advice.
Let me summarize that real quickly. By having parents and clinicians slow down, that might reduce stuttering because the child will not necessarily or will not slow their rate, but because of the slowed turn taking.
Right. That's exactly what we believe.
And that then in turn reduces the stuttering. And I'll tell you, in my own practice, which is mostly preschoolers, I find that in maybe 75% of my cases, the family loves slowing down and it really benefits the child. And with about 25% of the cases, it has no effect at all.
And yeah, right. Well, all of these things require individual problem solving because no child and their family are cookie cutter kinds of people. There are a couple of really interesting published case studies out there. One of them with Barry Guitar and Susie Myers in her fluency development kit had another set of examples, but she had data behind them, that when, for instance, you go into the turn-taking concept and you really reinforce it by teaching parents and kids, for instance, if they're around the dinner table, the usual model is, if they're around the dinner table, nobody can talk unless they're holding the salt shaker.
Right.
And you enforce this long turn taking, and you also make clear that people can't interrupt one another, then many children show dramatically fluent episodes during those periods of time, that a lot of communicative stress is off of them. And I would call it communicative stress. It's not so much language stress at that point as communicative stress, that they have time to say what they want to say, and nobody's going to interrupt them.
In Woody Starkweather's book with Janet Given Zuckerman, they talked about having a talking stick for the family.
Yeah, same thing. That book was written after Susie Myers did that sort of stuff, but that's exactly right. The talking stick, teddy bears, any sort of icon. It may not have even been original to Susie, but people have been talking about this for a while, and it does seem to work when it's tracked. The Barry Guitar study with Marcin Koski, I guess, is the second author. People can hunt it up. It was a really nice example of how you can plot changes in fluency when you actually implement something like that.
A couple more questions for you. It's not always clear to me when it's language or when it's something else. So, for, let's say, Lidcombe therapy, which the people who use Lidcombe will say that they either don't know why it's, quote, working, or that it's working because it's based on punishment. But this Lidcombe preschool therapy also starts at the one-word level. So is it punishment, or is it reducing language demands, or is it all the above, or something else?
We actually have one study on this. We were grateful that the Lidcombe people gave us some of their cases to look at about, it's getting to be almost a decade ago, but we published some work in about 2000 with them. We think it is language for some kids, not all, but maybe language for some kids, but in an odd way. What happens in Lidcombe, as you know and many of your listeners know, is that if the child has a stutter, every now and then those stutters are responded to, you could say they're punished, by asking the child to try again. What we know from our work is that if you look at an interaction between a kid and a parent or just a kid talking for whatever reason, most of the sentences that are going to be stuttered are going to be their longer and harder ones. What we found in tracking children in this program is that patterns of expressive language that they used after they got out were not only more fluent, but they were actually, their sentences were slightly shorter and simpler. And we didn't think this was really a bad deal, because actually one of the other things we noted about these kids was that some of their sentences going in were way longer and more complicated than we would have expected them to be given the child's age. So we think that some kids stutter, at least in part, not all of their stuttering is due to this, but some of their stuttering events are caused by really trying to, you know, bite off more than they can chew. They're just trying to say a sentence that's really much too hard for them to encode and produce purely, you know, perfectly fluently. When parents then ask them to try it again, they, like the rest of us, tend to start saying something shorter and simpler. Somebody asks us to repeat, we don't repeat exactly what we said before. And we think that some kids actually grab a hold of the notion that if they're going to say things that are long and hard, parents are going to make them start to repeat them, and they start talking slower and more simply. And that helps them get more fluent. The Lidcombe people are not entirely enchanted with this account, and we're not sure it's right for every child. But we think that there is a possibility that some children actually stumble on the notion that if you say shorter and simpler things, you can actually manage your fluency better. Without being told directly, because nobody's actually said to them, say things that are slower and simpler, they've just asked them to repeat casually every now and then. And so it's an alternative account. I think as time goes by, we'll be able to test it better. And I think right now there are people in Australia and Sydney doing that with some of the grant money, because they have taken that, they've taken that hypothesis seriously. But it requires really going in and looking at interactions very carefully to see if it's really happening.
Do you have time for one or two more questions?
Sure.
So let's say it could be a younger child, but for an older child, let's say in the 6th, 7th, 8th grade, I work with a bunch of kids who have really superior language skills, at least in English, and I find that decreasing their language isn't an option, even if I wanted to.
But, right, no, I mean, you can't tell people to speak more simply, you and I can't do that. How would we do that?
Of course. Well, yeah, but I guess I was saying that just so that our listeners knew where I was coming from. But what I do find is that if you paint over all their language, like let's say, I'm not saying I do this, but let's say you wanted them to speak like a robot, which is basically tampering down all emotion. So that's sort of like, it seems to almost negate the language demands. It's just painting over all of that with no emotions at all, and that tends to also reduce stuttering. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I have a couple. I think that when you get kids to speak more slowly or in the monotone, a couple of things happen. They have to pay so much attention to the rate, and in particular to those kinds of prosodic things, that they really can't split their attention to saying terribly interesting or new things. I mean, they really have trouble putting together complicated language. And actually, if you slow them down a lot, which many of these programs do, we basically only have a mental window for formulating utterances that's only so long. And it works that way when people are listening to that speech, too, is that you can hardly pay attention to it, because by the time you get the whole thought in, the beginning part of the thought's already starting to fade. So I think that when you slow rate, you make it tough for people to keep a long, complicated sentence in their buffer. And when you make a task cognitively demanding, like pay attention to your speech in various ways, you make it hard for them to plan a really complicated utterance. There are only so many ways you can multitask.
That makes a lot of sense.
I just have a comment about the advice or the general advice to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of makes me think, great, you can slow some children down, or you can give the advice in therapy to slow down and kind of use that model. But I can remember stuttering as a kid, and the problem I had was so much just on that first sound and sort of getting going. And, you know, just the act of slowing down the speech did not do anything for me.
I've seen a lot of therapists recommend that kids or adults pay most attention to the first word in an utterance and then let the rest fly. And I'm not sure that's an inappropriate recommendation. I think it creates more natural speech and probably gets rid of a hunk of stutters, which, as you and I all know, tend to collect around the very first item in an utterance. So if you can get that one out, yeah, you may have some others, but you've at least gotten rid of a big chunk of them. And it does have the added benefit of making the speech less conspicuous. So I think this is the kind of stuff that therapists and kids or adults need to explore together. But I think for some people, literally paying attention only to the first word and the first couple of sounds, like, you know, prolonging the first sound in an utterance, it's going to work for them to combat a fair number of their offense. And it won't have that same distressing kind of quality that sometimes accompanies instructions to change rate. I know a lot of therapists, when they instruct people to change rate, really don't monitor appropriately to make sure that people don't get into a monotone and sound robotic. And they're perfectly happy to have people come out sounding pretty conspicuous. And I don't think that that's a desired outcome of therapy.
And unfortunately, parents that I work with would take the robotic speech over stuttering. I'd say most parents, at least at first. I have one last question.
Sure.
To ask you, whether it's an adult or a child, do you think that when a person who stutters slows their speech on purpose, whether it's through pausing between their words or through a fluency shaping approach, do you think that allows the person more time to plan their language, thus reducing stuttering?
Not always. My reaction comes from two different thoughts here. We discourage, in fluency shaping training with our students, we discourage people inserting pauses. Because when a speaker inserts pauses, they're essentially starting from scratch with every word. And that essentially makes every word like the beginning of every utterance. So we think it actually makes it more likely that somebody's going to have problems. Normal speech from a person, normally fluent speech from people who don't stutter, has absolutely no spaces between words. And ironically, it's some of the pausing strategies that people have developed that seems to make it more likely that they'll be going from a vocal standstill position to sound from silence over and over again during an utterance, which you never find when typically fluent speakers speak. And if people, I know I talk rapidly, but if people listen to my sentences as I'm saying them now, there are no spaces between words, and they can listen to the evening news and they'll hear the same thing. So we urge people not to slow down by putting spaces in, but by making the elements longer inside a running speech stream. The second part of your question was whether or not if you slow down in any way, you can do more thinking as you're talking or do more planning. And I think that's only true to a point. As I said before, if you slow down a lot and you think a lot about manipulating the sounds between words, you're going to find it very difficult to do intelligent planning of what you're going to say. And one of the things we do worry about, these are things that are tough to measure, but when people are spending so much time on the mechanics of speech, how much time do they have to think about what they truly want to say here? And we don't believe that we make people good conversationalists if we take so much care and attention to only the motor stuff, and particularly motor stuff that really will make it tough for people to keep track of what they're trying to say.
Oh, well, that's great, Nan. Well, we want to thank you for joining us today at Stuttering 101. You've been here with Dr. Nan Bernstein-Ratner. Thank you, Nan.
Well, thank you for having me again. It's always a pleasure.